This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
If you enjoy Philosophy Bites, please support us. We're currently unfunded and all donations would be gratefully received. For details, go to www.philosophybites.com.
The 18th century thinker Jean-Jacques Rousseau was many things. Political theorist, educationist, botanist, composer, novelist, autobiographer, polemicist and recluse. But he was, perhaps above all, a psychologist. Chris Bertram is a Rousseau scholar at Bristol University.
Chris Bertram, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Hi.
The topic we're going to focus on is Rousseau's moral psychology. Now, just before we get onto the moral psychology, could you say a little bit about who Rousseau was?
Yeah, Rousseau is an 18th century philosopher, but also a composer, writer of novels, in fact, an all-round intellectual. He came from Geneva, born there in 1712. He really came to prominence in middle age as an autodidact in the Paris of the Salons in the 1750s. And he's famous now for a series of works, The Social Contract, Discourse on Inequality, Emile, which is a work of political philosophy. He wrote a novel called Julie, and at the time it was a tremendously exciting and semi-erotic treatment of human relationships. You read it today, it's a little bit boring, I'm afraid. But yes, his novel captivated an entire generation of the French aristocracy.
And another one of his remarkable achievements is his Confessions, which is a very intimate autobiography.
Yes, he set out, or he claims to have set out, to write an account of his own life from the inside, as it were, explaining how he became himself. The Confessions is, in fact, only one of several autobiographical works that he wrote, and they vary in the extent of their paranoia. He was a somewhat mentally unstable character. The Confessions may be the most readable of them, but also you have a work like The Reverie of the Solitary Walker, which came out at the end of his life, which is an absolutely beautiful meditation composed in a series of walks around Paris. And then you have the dialogues, which are this completely kind of mad exchange between a Frenchman and Jean-Jacques about this third character, Rousseau. So he's talking to somebody else about himself and asking whether all the terrible things he's heard about this crazy character are in fact true, or whether he's been maligned by his enemies.
So Rousseau was a complex character, very interested in his own psychology, but he was interested in human psychology generally.
Yes, he was. And he was interested in trying to discover how the characteristic attitudes and relationships of modern life came about, whether they're natural to us as a species or whether they're something that's developed in history, and whether the psychological problems that we face in our dealings with other people can somehow be resolved.
So what was his distinctive contribution here?
His contribution is really to see human flourishing as being a matter of our relationship to others and a matter of us achieving recognition as being of a certain status, as having a certain moral value in the eyes of other people.
So this is an acknowledgement of the social nature of our own self-esteem, that we need to be not just proud of what we've done, but somehow seen to be the right kind of person.
Yes, in order to have a satisfactory human life, it's not enough, he thinks, at least not for most people, just to achieve various goals. You have to achieve recognition in the eyes of other people. You have to be seen as being a person of value in the eyes of a loved one or your fellow citizens or your co-workers, the people around you. But the thing that he's really concerned about is that the striving that people have, the anguish that people have in trying to attain the respect of others, and the interest that people have in satisfying the expectation of others is subversive of the very goal of recognition that people are moved to pursue.
How does that work?
So supposing we live and work in a society very much like our own, a competitive and hierarchical society, then I've got a number of needs and wants, some of those material needs. So I need a salary, I need food, I need housing. And some of them are these psychic needs, the need to be respected by other people. Now, supposing I'm a high up in an institution, I'll no doubt earn a big salary, I'll have a nice house and so forth, and I'll also receive the adulation and respect of those who are subordinate to me in the organisation. At least they will speak to me as if they respect me. But how can I know, given that they depend on me for their livelihood, that they are giving me their respect sincerely? Rousseau thinks that I can't be sure of that, that I'll be filled with anxiety that they are just saying what they're saying about me because they have a material incentive to do so.
And then what happens?
Well, then what happens is that out of a sense of rage and insecurity, people are often drawn into conflict with one another.
That sounds a bit reminiscent of Thomas Hobbes's view of the sources of strife, that often it's just a look of disapproval or some kind of comment that puts somebody down that results in violence.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. Except I think Rousseau is perhaps more explicit about the social side of things as being almost an intrinsic aspect of human beings. For Rousseau, at least beyond the very initial stages of human development, we have integrated into our motivation this ineliminably social set of drives.
So we have these social drives, but does that mean we have to go along with them? I mean, do we have to then just accept that we are the kind of being that needs social approval and we're doomed to be made almost paranoid by this drive, and it's the fact that it is difficult to fulfill the aim of the drive because we can never trust that people aren't approving of us because it's in their interest, not mine?
Well, I don't think Rousseau is terribly consistent about this. So sometimes in despair, he suggests that the only real solution to the psychological problems that we face is to go it alone and to turn one's back on the world. For example, at the beginning of The Reverie of the Solitary Walker, he says, "Here I am, alone in the world, the most lovable of men, but everyone's turned their back on me." But then in perhaps not a more optimistic mood, but certainly in a slightly different mood, he tries to sketch various ways in which we might tame this craving for recognition. So in The Social Contract, he sketches an idea of a political society in which citizens, by recognizing one another as equals, can achieve a kind of satisfaction and can live in some kind of harmony together. And in his treatise on education, Emile, he talks about the way in which a young boy might be brought up so that his mind would be more ordered and so that these drives for recognition and respect would have their proper place.
So is that the total of his moral psychology? Is it just a matter of self-esteem in relation to other people?
No, in fact, he builds up a historical and genetic picture of how that drive for recognition in the eyes of others emerges from more primitive elements of motivation. He has this idea that all beings, including human beings, have a fundamental motivational drive, which he calls self-love, amour de soi, a motivation to take care of oneself and one's most basic interests. And alongside that is something he calls pitié, which we could translate by compassion, an instinct to take an interest in the suffering of others, a disposition, if you see someone else suffering, to run towards them to try and alleviate their suffering. So those are two basic elements, and then he builds on those elements, together with other psychological aspects like free will and the capacity that human beings have to learn and to improve themselves, and tells a whole story about how from these primitive elements eventually emerges this disposition to care deeply about what other people think of you.
And what term does he use for that?
Amour propre is his word for that. So both amour de soi and amour propre, literally translated into English, mean self-love. But amour de soi is essentially a drive to care for oneself mainly as a natural being. If you have amour de soi, you want to be warm, you want to be well-fed, you want to be free of disease, all of those kind of things. Amour propre, on the other hand, which in some works he describes in an overwhelmingly negative way, but not in all of them, sometimes translated as pride or vanity, is this impulse to be respected, be cared about by other people.
And does Rousseau think that the amour propre just emerges from a certain kind of society, a kind of civilized so-called society?
No, he has amour propre emerging at a much earlier stage. So in the Discourse on Inequality, he tells this tale, which starts with very primitive, solitary creatures wandering through the woods, occasionally bumping into one another and mating with one another, but really having no genuine social interaction. And then by a process which, to be honest, is a little obscure in the text, the population of these creatures rises and they come to engage in some basic forms of cooperation around things like hunting. And then eventually there's a transformation in the self-consciousness of these creatures. In fact, you could say there's a birth of self-consciousness, because they start to become aware of the world in a different way. Instead of seeing the world as composed just of objects that can be more or less useful to them in the pursuit of their aims, they start to see the world as also containing these other people, and these other people who they are looking at are also looking back at them. And so you start to have this dynamic relationship where people start to see themselves as others might see them for the first time. Now, in different books, Rousseau tells a slightly different story about this, but essentially he thinks that a stage comes about in human development called the Golden Age, which is a rather simple form of society, and the people in these small communities, they start to have these basic forms of interaction, and they start to be interested in love and sex. And as they start to be interested in love and sex, they start to notice that other people are looking upon them with lust or affection, and that they look on other people in that way. But also they start to notice that some people prefer some others to themselves, and they start to experience things like pangs of jealousy. And this leads to the first beginnings of human conflict.
How does Rousseau get beyond this? I mean, how does he get to the sort of modern conception of a society where people are treated equally?
Well, he doesn't think that people in the society in which we live are treated equally. He thinks that there is a small outside possibility that human beings in societies like our own, or at least in societies of the 18th century, could refound society in ways that would be psychologically satisfactory for them. But he's basically a pessimist. He thinks we have the materials to refound society in this way, but that it's vanishingly unlikely that we'll actually get our acts together to do it.
Okay, we've got the materials. What's the recipe?
Well, there are two recipes. One is an educational and erotic recipe, and the other is a political recipe. The educational recipe is about educating someone in such a way that these various elements of their psychological makeup don't become disordered, that this drive for recognition doesn't develop in children too soon. And then eventually he hopes that a relationship of love with another human being in which you feel loved and give love in return, that could satisfy your craving for respect. But he also thinks that there might be a political solution. And the political solution is founded in an idea of a small city-state or a small community. And in that community, people coming together under a rule of law guided by what he calls the general will could be in a relationship of non-domination with one another. So there aren't people in that society who oppress other people, who subject them to their will, their whims, their desires. Rather, everybody is subject to a law that everybody has made. Everyone is equal, and everybody, at least in a certain role, the role of citizen, gives and receives respect from others.
And this general will isn't just the aggregate total of what everybody wants, is it? It's not that everybody in the society votes for the thing they most want.
That's right. Well, in fact, the general will is a complicated idea. It has at least two sides to it. On the one hand, for Rousseau, sometimes it takes apparently a straightforwardly democratic guise. So we have the idea that the citizens in the assembly deliberate on a series of basic laws that spell out their constitutional relationship to one another. And so the general will, in that view, is just what those citizens decide. But sometimes he has a more abstract or transcendental notion of the general will, where the general will is a kind of fact of the matter about the common interest that is independent of what people actually happen to think about it, and people can therefore be mistaken about what the general will is.
And famously, they can be forced to be free.
Yes, that's a passage in the Social Contract that many commentators over the centuries have seized upon as evidence of Rousseau's supposed totalitarianism. But actually, you can find quite similar passages in other philosophers who nobody really suspects of totalitarianism, in Kant, in Locke as well. And the basic idea is that in order not to be subject to the arbitrary will of other people, in order not to be subject to relationships of power and domination, we all have to put up with and recognise a set of rules that limits our freedom. So it's true our freedom is limited by the law, but if we tried to expand our freedom by undermining and evading the law, then we'd end up being less free. So that's the sense in which we're being forced to be free.
You've obviously spent a lot of time reading Rousseau's work. Do you think he is a major philosopher?
Yes, I think so. He's not, for much of the time, a systematic philosopher, although there is a systematic core at the centre of his thought. He would have rejected the idea that he was a philosopher. He had a lot of contempt for philosophers, moralists, people who worked on the theory of law. And the reason he had that contempt is that he thought of a lot of moral philosophy as essentially being a system of systematic rationalization of bad desires, power, self-interest. He thought that good philosophy would indeed be founded on moral reasons, considerations of conscience, but most of the time, moral philosophy, political philosophy, is about rationalization of interest and power.
Chris Bertram, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us.